Our guest is Wayne Green, and I really don't know how to give this gentleman an introduction. And the reason why is because there's about a million different ways I could introduce him. My introduction to Wayne Green was as a young man reading 73 magazine that had some of the most interesting and the most challenging editorial articles having to do with amateur radio. And it was a wonderful, wonderful publication. Matter of fact, I just went through a bunch of my old boxes and drug out several issues of 73. And I'm really amazed when I look at the content of this magazine. And I realize after looking at it now how much I really miss it. And that's only one facet of this gentleman that we're going to be talking with here. And he's a man of many, many accomplishments. And so many that I think I'd make an idiot out of myself trying to describe them. So I'm just gonna say, hello, Wayne, how are you today?
I'm doing just fine there, Ted. Thank you.
I would like to ask some questions about 73, though. I'd like to know when it was that you started that magazine.
I started that back in 1960. And the purpose of it was primarily at that time to get more hams building equipment, because I'd been building equipment for many years and enjoyed it. And I'd been the editor of CQ magazine for 5 years before that. So I got to know everybody pretty well. And they got to where they owed me so much back money, owed me a year's back pay, so they fired me. And so I said, the heck, I just enjoy doing this so much, I started my own magazine. I had just enough money to publish the first issue.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was going through my old issues, and I was looking at the schematics of different little projects. And they were all interesting things, you know, real captivating little projects, some of them big projects, but nonetheless, and I don't want anybody to take offense to this, but I mean, I remember looking at the other amateur radio publications, and a lot of the stuff they had in there was just boring. I mean, it was like, why would I want to build that, you know? But the stuff in 73 was always cool stuff, unusual things. And
well, yeah, I always pushed the envelope on new technologies, pioneering new things. So when I first got started in amateur radio, VHF was the new thing, and so I built a 2.5-meter transceiver using two tubes, and had a wonderful time with that. And then when narrowband FM was invented, I was one of the first ones active with that. And, of course, that's what's used now standard on most of the VHF communications and so forth. I've been pioneering things right down through history here.
Well, but not just 73 magazine. Let me ask you this before we go into something else. What attracted you originally to amateur radio?
Well, my grandfather was an inventor, and he made quite a lot of money before the 1929 crash. Was a millionaire, and of course he lost everything in the crash. But that didn't stop him, and he died in 1935. And he smoked, so he got sick and died from that. And about 6 or 7 months later, a friend of mine, Alfie, and I went to church one Sunday morning to go to Sunday school. And a fellow came in with a big box of radio parts and asked Alfie if he was interested. And Alfie said, no, ask Wayne. So I said, you bet. And it will take a lot of convincing to convince me that that wasn't an angel goaded by my grandfather, because that got me started. In Popular Mechanics, they had an article on how to build a cigar box radio, and I had the parts for it, so I built one, and it worked. I was hooked. And when I went to high school, I joined a radio club, and they got me to get my ham radio license, of course. And I just had a wonderful time building things down through the years, and loved it, and always into new things.
Well, now
that's how it started.
When you built the cigar box radio, what kind of receiver was that?
Well, it was a little AM broadcast receiver. But it worked.
Was it tube, crystal radio, or?
Oh, this was tubes, sure.
So you had building tubes in a cigar box radio. Well, you know, that's but the thing of it is that we've lost so much, I think, sometimes. I mean, I think we've gained a lot technology-wise. But there's something about the magic of that. And I think that you kind of capture it telling the story. Well, but what about ham radio? I mean, ham radio is a distance away from building a receiver in a cigar box. How did you happen into amateur radio?
Well, I was building things, and of course I got more and more. The next thing was an all band receiver that I built, and that introduced me to the ham bands. And so the more I listened to that, I said, "Hey, I got to do that." And I went and visited a ham a few blocks away from me and got on the air from his station with him and had a wonderful time. Back in those days, on 160 meters, we could have five or six stations all talking to each other at once. And they outlawed that later, but interestingly enough, a couple years ago I visited Art Bell. And got on the air from his station, and lo and behold, there was W2LBF, the fellow that I had visited and gotten on the air from before I got my ham license in Brooklyn, New York. So we had a wonderful time talking about old times.
Now, was that on sideband or was that on AM?
Oh, that's on sideband on 75 meters, yeah.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is there's still a real pretty good-sized crowd on 75 that's still doing AM.
Yep, oh, sure. Well, it has higher quality, but it takes up a lot more bandwidth. So I go with the new things. I was one of the first ones on single sideband. As a matter of fact, in 1959, I flew around the world with a sideband, 20-meter sideband transceiver on the plane. And stopped at, 32 countries on the way around, talking with hams all the way around and visiting with them as we stopped. And that was all sideband back in 1959, and that was the early days.
What was the, I know you've obviously, you got involved with so many different facets of radio, but what was it in ham radio early on that was the most fascinating thing to you? I know you said building. But there should have been, there might have been, could have been, an area that fascinated you more than others.
Well, I built, ham radio transmitters. I built receivers. I built audio amplifiers. I was into hi-fi way back in the, 1940, 1938, and so forth. I was one of the pioneers in that field.
So when you say
build anything.
when you say hi-fi now, you're not talking about, you're talking about pre-stereo days.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah, came along in the 60s.
So when did you see the first magnetic phonograph pickup?
Well, let's see. I had one with me when I joined the Navy in 1942. I had my own record player that I'd built, complete with a magnetic head and so forth, and an amplifier. And I took along a big carton of 78 RPM classical records with me, and on the submarine.
So you were on a submarine.
Yeah, I spent World War II on a submarine in the Pacific. Matter of fact, my boat is on display down in Mobile, Alabama. And you'll see a picture of me 65 years ago is how I looked.
Oh, my goodness. So what was it, how did you adapt to submarine life? Did you like that?
Oh, I liked it, sure. And, I was in charge of the electronic equipment. I kept the radar, the sonar, the radio, and so forth, everything working. And when it was battle stations, I was on the radar if we're on the surface, or on the sonar if we were submerged. So I was right in the middle of everything. And I had a lot of fun with that. Matter of fact, I had a little remote unit in my bunk so that I could see what was on the radar just by looking up while I was in my bunk taking a nap and so forth. I'd look up and see what was doing on the radar.
Well, now, how did you enter the military, and describe a little bit about your military career? How long did that go on?
Well, for 4 years. We had a war, World War II, and I was in college at the time. And then along about 1942, it became obvious that I was going to get drafted because they were drafting just about everybody. So I said, you know, heck, I don't want to go through that mill. And I tried to join the Air Force, and they wouldn't have me because I had hay fever and asthma. So then a fellow who had worked for my father was now a lieutenant in the Navy. And he got me an appointment to meet with the commander of the laboratory in Anacostia, Virginia, right across from Washington, D.C. So I went down and interviewed with Commander Bourne, and he said, wow, I want you to work for me, but of course, first you have to go to radar school so you'll know what you're doing. And I said, fine. He said, now when you graduate, let me know, and we'll cut your orders to get back here and work in the lab. So I went to radar school for 9 months. And they took kids that didn't know an ohm from a volt, and in 9 months had them able to repair anything electronic. It was a spectacular course, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I came out right on top for the first time in my life. I always was a C student in school, but there I was A+. So when it came time to graduate, I said, gee, you know, I think the people working in the lab probably ought to be married guys that have a family, and I better go to sea. And, you know, if I get, won't hurt a family. So it was a question of going on destroyers or submarines because I had to be in charge. I don't take orders well, and matter of fact, not well at all. And the pay was better than the and so forth for submarines, and it was a little more exciting, so I volunteered for submarines. And I flunked the physical. That was funny because I went in to take the physical to get on submarines. And I memorized the eye chart, DEFPOTEC one way, and backwards is CETOPFED. I still remember it for the 2020 line. But my eyesight was good. That wasn't a problem. However, they said, well, you're overweight, and therefore we have to disqualify you. And I said, well, how much overweight? And they said, well, about 8 pounds. And I said, okay, this is Friday. If I come back Monday 8 pounds lighter, do I get in? And they said, sure. So over the weekend, I went out and ran over the obstacle course endlessly and took steam baths and so forth and came back 10 pounds lighter on Monday. And they said, wow, but you've got flat feet, so we have to disqualify you. So I went back to the school, and they said, did you pass? And I said, sure. And the next thing you know, I was on a submarine. And it said in my, you know, during a depth charge, I'd get out my jacket there and from the yeoman and look at where it said I was disqualified for submarine duty. But at any rate, that's how I got on submarines.
Well, that's quite an amazing story. It really is. I mean, that's, well, you know, you must have really wanted to do that. I mean, really had it set or focused in your mind that that's where you were headed and that was what you wanted to get done.
Well, I liked it, and I liked being in charge, and the captain let me do what I wanted.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break.
I didn't like to take orders.
And it sounds like you still don't like to take orders. We're going to take it, and I'm saying that with a good nature. You're not going to hang up on me now, are you?
No. If people ask me to do things, I'll do almost anything. If they tell me to, they can go to hell.
Well, you know, I think that's almost human nature. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back right after this. Well, I guess I'm not going to tell you to do anything. I may ask you a couple questions here. That'll be okay, won't it?
Oh, sure. My father never got used to that.
Well, what about...
Even after a bunch of spankings.
What do you think, you know, formed your interest, I mean, as a kid? You know, I mean, I know you said your dad... Well, your introduction to radio came with some parts and whatnot, but... You know, growing up as a child, what do you remember? What are the things you remember that you think maybe caused your focus to go in a particular direction? Or how did that work?
Well, my grandfather, as I said, was an inventor. And he's the one who invented the thermostat for gas ovens and things like that. So... And he taught me, you know, how to do glass blowing and that sort of stuff. So I was kind of inclined in that direction. And when the radio came along, it got me. And I'm still convinced that and did that after he died.
Okay, you were saying you were very fortunate.
I was very fortunate as a child. My mother knew how to feed me, and this was 80 years ago. She fed me no cold cereal, no jam, no jelly, no sugar. I had hot cereal or eggs, usually soft-boiled, which meant that the yolk was not cooked and about half of the white wasn't cooked. We're getting close to raw there, and lots of fruits and vegetables and so forth. And she read to me during meals, got me interested in, as soon as I learned to read, I started reading books one after the other, and read all of the Oz books and so forth, and just loved reading, and I still do. So... one of the things I try to get people to do is that, hey, look, there are so many fascinating books out there. Don't spend all your time just entertaining yourself with television and ball games and things like that. Build your, you know, you're here for a lifetime. Make the most of it and learn as much as you can because you'll need that later. So... I read a lot of books.
Well, you talk about reading because you developed you were a pioneer actually in the computer industry because you began a publication, and that was Byte Magazine.
Well, let's go back to what happened and how that started. In amateur radio, we had a few clubs around the country that were extending the range of their mobile units and their handy talkies with what we called repeaters, which were automatic relay stations on top of mountains and tall buildings. And this looked like a lot of fun, so I started publishing articles on it. And I put one up in the local mountain here, Pacmanadnock, and it made it so that any mobile ham anywhere in New England could talk to any other, and I could talk to any of them with my little handy-talkie over a range of about 50 to 100 miles. So I said, wow, this is great. And I published hundreds of articles on it in my 73 magazine. I published a special journal, a repeater journal. And I went down and got the FCC to change their rules and regulations to favor repeaters and so forth. And I kept writing in my editorials. And I said, hey, look, I'm able to ski the mountains of New Hampshire, Vermont, and Colorado, and make telephone calls anywhere in the world through the local ham radio repeater. And I said, everybody in the world's going to want to be able to do this. Well, they took my editorials to the top people at Motorola. And that's how we got cell phones. That's where it started. So In 1975, January, a little outfit down in Albuquerque, New Mexico, put out a kit for computer hobbyists. And I got one and put it together, and I said, I think I can do it again. I see the future. And I started, within a few weeks, I started a magazine called Byte, B-Y-T-E, which became eventually the largest magazine in the country, running 700-800 pages a month. And then I started Microcomputing Magazine for the more technically minded, 80 Micro for people with a Radio Shack computer, Insider for people with the Apple computer, Run for people with a Commodore computer, Coco for people with a color computer, and so forth. I started one of the first software companies called Instant Software, and we developed over 250 programs and of all kinds, business and educational and fun games and so forth. So I was the first publisher and the largest publisher in the computer field. And then when I'd done that, I finally sold everything to Computer World and went on to work with Compact Discs, which had just been developed. And the hi-fi magazines and the audio magazines and the music magazines all said, oh, we don't need another medium. We're always going to have LPs. We like LP sound. And I said, baloney. And started a magazine called CD Review, Compact Disc Review. And I had the readers review every CD they bought for sound quality and performance. And the ones that we rated 10-10 sold like crazy. Our readers were spending $30 million a month for them. Became the largest music magazine in the country within a year. And so forth. And I had a lot of fun with that. Built my own recording studio out in the barn, state of the art. Turned out a bunch of CDs and pushed independent music and built the market for independent music from 4% of the market up to 16% of the market. That's over $1 billion a year in sales. So I had a lot of fun doing those things.
It's something that amazed me, and I'll be the one to ask you, because it seems like in living in the Nashville area, you could ask this question to some engineer somewhere that would know, but it doesn't seem like I can't get an answer. I was so disappointed when I would purchase certain CDs that the vinyl on a good turntable actually sounded better than the compact disc. And I thought, how is that possible? Because, you know, I mean, you know, it just doesn't seem right, you know. But I could take the analog recording off of the good turntable, I could record it into a computer and burn it to CD.
Mm-hmm.
And I had very, very close, almost imperceivable difference between the CD I had recorded and the original vinyl.
Well, my magazine forced the major studios, the major record companies, to rebuild their studios because they were designed for LP quality. In other words, they didn't have any real highs or real lows. And little things like air conditioners didn't make any difference for LPs, but with CDs they did. So anyway, we did, by having the CDs reviewed by the readers, it made it so that the bum ones fell away. And the early CDs were pretty crummy, most of them. They didn't do a good job of that. But we built up the quality very quickly because the ones that got a 10-10 rating sold like crazy. So anyway, that's the way that worked.
Well, you know, you talked a little bit about health, and you talked about...
No, I talk a lot about health.
Well, no, I said you talked a little bit about health just a few minutes ago. You were talking about your mom knowing how to feed you.
Right.
And, of course, unfortunately, today, I don't guess there's very many young folks that are being fed anywhere near correctly. And we've yet to see the outcome of all of that. We already know what the outcome of the baby boomers, if we want to call, I don't even know who they are. I mean, I've heard, you know, references to two or three different generations of being baby boomers, but nonetheless, we are a nation of out of shape, diseased, fat people who are dying on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And Wayne, you know, you have a handle on this. I mean, you really do have a handle on it. There's a half a dozen people in the country that seems to have an idea, at least a half a dozen that I know of. I'm sure there's more, but you know, my scope of understanding and what I know is limited. But I know for a fact that you're on the right track and you know what's going on. So, Mike, I'm just going to ask this, and I want you to take it from there, and that is, okay, your mom fed you correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said you went through a period of time where you you had gotten overweight. You were obviously in military. What happened since then, and what have you learned?
Well, what I've learned is that, and this is the biggest secret in the world, the biggest cover-up, I should say, and that is that you can cure any illness with no drugs. And I've got some pretty good doctors behind me on that. Now, I'll say that again. You can cure any illness with no drugs. And I'm talking about cancer, a total cure with no drugs, without fail, 100% of the time. I'm talking about curing AIDS, diabetes, anything. It doesn't. Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, total cure, and it's easy. But you do have to change your lifestyle. It is what we are doing to ourselves that is causing all of this misery. And I've done the homework on that. you can go to a website like Dr. Lorraine Day's, drday.com. And when I put everything together, I said, look, we have an immune system built into our bodies. And this is the repair and maintenance department. And it can fix anything if you let it. But we are so busy putting toxic substances into and on our bodies, and the immune system is so busy fighting them, sending out the white cells and so forth to fight them, that other things get away. For instance, with cancer, the cells in our body, millions of them, are duplicating themselves every day. Well, it's the immune system's job to go in there and check and make sure that the replication is right. Because if there's an error, you can have a cancer cell. And it's the immune system's job to find that and trash it. Well, if you keep it so busy with toxins that you're putting into your body that it can't do its job, you're going to get cancer. And the way it is right now, if people continue with their diet, 50%, one half of the people are going to get cancer. And they're going to go to the doctor, and they're going to go to chemotherapy and so forth, and they're going to die. Now, if you go to DRDAY, you find Dr. Lorraine Day, a leading trauma surgeon in San Francisco, wonderful bona fides. Just take a look at the letter she sent to AARP when they called her a snake oil salesman. But then AARP is kept alive by advertising by pharmaceutical industry, as are most magazines. I was just counting the pages of ads in the latest issue of Newsweek, and it's 13 2/3 pages of pharmaceutical ads. You can bet that you're never going to hear a word in there about how easy it is to cure any illness. So how do you cure them? You stop the toxins. And what are the toxins? Well, we know a few of them. We know that alcohol is toxic, nicotine, caffeine. Heck, with caffeine, one drop of pure caffeine injected into your body will kill you. And that morning cup of coffee sends your immune system for a loop for a while and so forth. And that gives you a fast pickup and then lets you down and makes you tired and fatigued and cranky a little bit later. Then we have sugar. Sugar is a terribly addictive substance, pure sugar, cane sugar. So we have things like white flour products, which have no good to them, are toxic. But the sleeper, the one that is the most surprising and the one that is causes the most difficulty, is cooked food. As soon as you cook food, it becomes toxic. It kills the enzymes. It kills the vitamins. It kills the phytonutrients in the food. And the immune system tackles it as toxic with white cells, and down goes your immune system. So we're talking about a raw food diet. And, of course, milk is pasteurized, which means it's dead. And then we compound that by homogenizing it, which breaks down the fat particles so small that they really do a job on your arteries and rip them up. So a wonderful book by Robert Cohen called Milk, the Deadly Poison. 40 years ago, Dr. Henry Beeler went into hospitals where children were there with incurable leukemia, there to die, and he cured every one of them. What he did was take them off all milk products and fed them minced raw liver. And I know everybody says, ugh, I could never eat that. Well, I get phone calls regularly from people saying, I read your book, The Secret Guide to Health, and you said that liver was good. And so if you get a good liver, that is from a cow that has been raised on grass, or a buffalo, raised on grass with no growth hormones and no antibiotics and so forth. And what you do is you take the liver and put it into either a Cuisinart or one of these ultimate choppers that they're selling on television. That's what I use. It minces it in about 1 second, salt and pepper, and it's delicious. And I have people calling me saying, you know, Wayne, I never thought I could eat that, but you said it was good. So I tried it. Wayne, I love it.
Okay, raw liver. But now yep. You can't go into the supermarket and
with salt and pepper. With my supermarkets, you can. The Shaw's supermarkets up here have a wild harvest section with buffalo meat.
They have buffalo meat there. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. And of course, different people living in different parts of the country are going to have a different choices, and especially throughout Europe, you're going to have different places where people are going to be able to purchase certain things and other folks that can't. So I would say if you don't have some place like what you're talking about, let me ask you this. Would you advise, you know, eating raw meat from the average grocery store?
Absolutely not.
I wanted to ask that question because
you've got to find a local farm. I've got several around here that have good beef, wholesome beef, and two buffalo farms locally.
Well, how important is the raw meat? If a person wanted to go on a raw food diet, and let's say that they went on a raw vegetable diet, which a lot of folks I know would probably say they could tolerate that until they worked up enough nerve to try the raw meat. But how vital or how needed is the raw meat? I mean,
we're omnivores, and our ancestors were hunter-gatherers. In the winter, they ate meat because they couldn't gather anything. So our bodies are designed for that. Yes, you can get along pretty good on just vegetables and fruits if you eat them raw. But we do need the B12 and things that you get just from meat.
Now, let me ask you, and I'm curious about this. Does Lorraine Day...
She's a vegetarian.
Okay, I was going to say, she does not advocate the raw meat. Now, is she like opposed to it, though? Does she say, no, we don't do that? Or
I don't think she is, because she read my book and called up and said, Wayne, your book is right on the money.
Okay, well, I didn't know, because, I mean, it's like I had a conversation with Jack LaLanne, and Jack LaLanne said, I eat nothing but raw vegetables, and I eat fish, he says, about twice mm-hmm. a week. And so I started asking him questions, and he was basically saying, well, no, it's perfectly okay to eat chicken. It's okay to eat beef. He said, it's just something that I don't do.
Yeah. You
know, and that was what he was saying. But, you know.
Sure. Well, he never tasted it.
Well, let me ask you a question. Is it the heat? Is it all cooked foods? I mean, for example, if you make a big pot of vegetable soup, is it just, I mean, are you saying that?
It's dead.
It's useless.
It's dead.
So what about the chicken soup when I've had a cold?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. When I have a cold and I'm all plugged up, I want my chicken soup. So,
well, you know, if you go on a raw food diet, you'll never get a cold or a flu again the rest of your life.
Now, see, there you have it right there. We're going to take a break.
Or anything else. Your immune system can handle anything.
We'll take a quick break.
If you let it.
We'll be right back with Wayne Green right after this.